Thank you for tuning in to the WOLA Podcast, Latin America Today, and the Just the Facts Podcast. It's Friday, August 31st, 2012. I'm Adam Isaacson, the Senior Associate for Regional Security Policy here at WOLA. It's time for another Week Ahead podcast. I'll be talking about peace prospects in Colombia, police shooting at CIA personnel in Mexico, and a big U.S. Marine operation in Guatemala. Let's start in Colombia, where word got out on Monday, and then President Juan Manuel Santos confirmed that evening that his government has quietly been holding exploratory talks with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, guerrillas. The goal of the dialogues is to try to end an internal armed conflict that's been raging for 48 years. These would be the first acknowledged talks between the Colombian government and the FARC since 2002. The intervening 10 years have seen at least 22,000 Colombians killed in combat, and thousands of others, mainly civilians, killed by other conflict-related violence. Information's still kind of sketchy, but here's what we know, and I should warn that all of this is from news reports. The Colombian government, FARC, and the government serving as facilitators aren't revealing much at this point. We don't know who's leaking this information or why, and we don't know how much of this is actually accurate. I'm just going to go over what's being widely reported. Between either January or February and now, several sessions, perhaps six sessions of talks, have taken place between FARC and Colombian government representatives in Havana, Cuba. Both sides seem to have reached some point of agreement on Monday, and something may be announced over the next several days. These talks have had international accompaniment. Cuba and Norway are serving as guarantor countries. Venezuela and Chile are serving as accompanying countries. Some sort of more formal talks with these countries' participation are to take place in October, perhaps, in Oslo, Norway. The talks will then move to Havana and continue there. The last time official talks took place between the FARC and the Colombian government was between 1998 and 2002. This process back then, which took place between the government of President Andrés Pastrana and a series of FARC leaders, many of whom are now dead, happened in a demilitarized zone in south-central Colombia, comprising five sparsely populated counties. These talks made very little progress over 4 years. They lacked outside mediators, they happened while some very intense fighting was going on, and ultimately they fell apart after the FARC hijacked an airplane and kidnapped a Colombian senator in February 2002. Unlike that last peace process, this one will have international mediators helping to keep things on track. It will be happening outside of Colombia and not in territory ceded to the guerrillas, which was hugely unpopular during the Pastrana years. The FARC's agreement to negotiate without the demilitarized zone is an important stand down from their earlier position. In part because of this, observers this week have been guardedly optimistic that perhaps this time, in what would be the fourth set of official dialogues with the FARC since 1982, the outcome might be successful. The FARC are weaker, perhaps half the size that they were 10 years ago. They've lost many of the top leaders who are the organization's most visible faces during the last peace talks. The current leadership may take a more pragmatic approach this time. There may be more of a realization that just taking a deal now is better than many more years of fighting with little chance of ever taking power. On the Colombian government side, there's probably more willingness to talk as well. While the Colombian government has dealt the FARC some key blows over the last several years, there's actually been a modest increase in FARC activity since about 2008, even despite the combat deaths of some of their top leaders. This increase in activity has made it plain that even though the FARC are weaker, the conflict is still not in its home stretch and that a military victory could take many more years. The news of the talks has been very well received. Statements of support have come from the United States, the European Union, the UN Secretary General, the OAS, church and business groups. The Colombian military has indicated that they're not opposed, and retired officers may have had some role even in the talks so far. A Gallup poll released Friday found 60% of Colombians favoring the option of negotiations over the option of continuing to fight the FARC. That's up 8 points since June. The number of Colombians saying it is better to fight than negotiate fell from 44 to 37%. In an interview, the leader of the smaller ELN, or National Liberation Army guerrilla group, which is just as old as the FARC, also expressed openness to a peace process, and President Santos said that the ELN could participate in the same framework of discussions. A document leaked on Wednesday that news outlets claim may be the agenda that the peace talks are to follow was made public, but none of those involved in the talks acknowledged the document, and it may not be the absolutely final version. However, it envisions a negotiation covering six issues to be taken up in this order. First, rural development policy. Second, the FARC's future political participation. Third, bringing the conflict to an end, including a ceasefire. Fourth, solving the problem of illegal drugs. Fifth, the conflict's victims and how to help them. And sixth, details of implementation and verification. Among these issues is the FARC's eventual disarmament. This is new. In the 1980s, the FARC had an earlier peace process in which they even created a political party, the Patriotic Union. It viewed the Patriotic Union as sort of its eventual entry into civilian politics. It ran candidates, many of whom were elected. But by the mid-1990s, long after that peace process had failed, as many as 3,000 Patriotic Union members were murdered. Because of this experience, the FARC has long rejected the idea of becoming a political party and turning in its weapons, like the FMLN did in El Salvador. They've even said for years that they intend to keep some weapons after any peace process. So it's a big deal that the FARC may be dropping this stance and entertaining the idea of turning in their weapons. Now, one immediate challenge right away is the lack of a ceasefire from the get-go. A cessation of hostilities is put off for the third point of the agenda, and they're negotiating these things in order. This means that for some time there will be negotiations happening amid fighting. While the FARC agreed unilaterally back in February to stop kidnapping for ransom, they've made no pledge to stop attacking the military or even civilian targets, to stop using landmines, to stop engaging in narco-trafficking, or to stop recruiting child soldiers. All that activity may continue during the initial talks, and if it does, it could do some damage to confidence in the process. Now, a cessation of hostilities had been a precondition that President Santos had publicly set since being inaugurated in August of 2010. It was his position that the FARC must stop these activities before talks begin. Going back on that demand leaves Santos in a weaker position with regard to public opinion if the talks don't make some quick progress. Also, with no ceasefire in place, it wouldn't be surprising to see a jump in violence, because both sides may try to gain advantage at the negotiating table by making shows of force on the battlefield. Also, negotiating amid fighting will give fuel to the peace talks' political opponents, especially Álvaro Uribe, Colombia's president between 2002 and 2010, and now President Santos's most vocal critic. Uribe has already lashed out against the talks, accusing Santos of abandoning Colombia's security in favor of negotiating with terrorists. Quote, 2 years of clandestine talks, demoralizing the armed forces, weakening security, and legitimizing Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, the protector of terrorists, quote, he wrote on Twitter. Even once talks start, there'll be some tricky obstacles to overcome. For one, how much political content can the talks really have? The FARC is unpopular in Colombia because of its notorious brutality and practices like kidnapping. It has very few political allies in Colombia, so it's hard to imagine that it's in any position to extract political concessions from the Colombian government, like economic or political reforms. However, the draft agenda that surfaced on Wednesday does include some political items like rural development policy, drug policy, so the most likely outcome will be some very modest reforms, something agreed to in order to give the FARC something resembling a graceful exit without demanding too deep a sacrifice from Colombia's government. Another issue to confront is whether the FARC leadership can actually deliver its rank and file after a peace process ends. The FARC is a far-flung organization. Its communications have been badly disrupted. Not clear how much command and control they have right now. Should the FARC leadership call on them to demobilize in the future, it wouldn't be surprising to see some of the younger mid-level members and the units that they command refusing to turn in their weapons. They may prefer to stay in the field where they're making money from things like drug trafficking or illegal mining. These recalcitrant FARC structures could end up resembling the paramilitary successor groups, the criminal bands, or BACRIM, who are carrying out a lot of violence in Colombia right now. If the process is to succeed, the number of these rogue units has to be minimized. The third question is, what about the many FARC leaders who are accused of crimes against humanity? A recently passed peace framework law in Colombia might allow some serious human rights violators to avoid punishment. However, Colombia is a signatory to the 1998 Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court. This means that it can't amnesty the most serious human rights crimes. Some sort of trial or alternative punishment regime is going to have to apply to the most notorious FARC leaders. But if this arrangement is too strict, these leaders would probably prefer to keep fighting instead of just turning in their weapons and just marching into a jail cell. Colombia's going to have to find a way out of this that respects the rights of the FARC's victims. For now, the next steps aren't all that clear. We have to await further word from the parties and the facilitators, and we must also respect the secrecy at the same time that these delicate negotiations are going to require. This will be tough. This is an era of social media, blogs, press outlets needing a big scoop, and of course insiders on the inside who may want to sabotage things by leaking information. Colombia, and especially the facilitators, are going to have to balance the need for secrecy with the equally important need to include input from key stakeholders, especially victims and organizations of people affected by the conflict. Let's turn to Mexico, where a week ago Friday, a bizarre, violent incident took place on the highway between Mexico City and Cuernavaca, which lies about an hour and a half to the south of the capital. Mexican federal police ambushed and fired on a heavily armored SUV with diplomatic plates. In the vehicle were two men, reported at first as being tied to the U.S. Embassy. The men were wounded. Their interpreter, a Mexican Navy officer who was in the back seat, was unharmed, and he phoned for help. The SUV was chased on the highway by four vehicles and hit by more than 30 bullets. Its armor mostly held up. According to one account, once the American vehicle was unable to move, the Mexican police left their vehicles and ran over to the American's car, shooting the whole time. Only after the Americans showed their credentials through the window did one of the police shout a code word that stopped the shooting. Days later, press reports revealed that the U.S. Embassy personnel in fact worked for the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States. The left-leaning daily La Jornada broke that story. The CIA officers or contractors, we don't know which, were on their way to a Mexican Marine training camp where they were serving as trainers. The CIA has increased its activities in Mexico since the Mérida Initiative aid package began in 2008. According to the Washington Post, quote, former senior CIA officials said the agency has shared intelligence with Mexico and helped its elite counter-narcotics teams root out corruption and identify officers with ties to drug lords, end quote. Mexican media outlets revealed that one of the wounded American's name was listed as Stan D. Boss. That is one of dozens of names that public records show as having the same address, a post office box in Dunloring, Virginia, which is out in the D.C. suburbs. This P.O. box has been used before for the mailing addresses of people whose names turned out to be aliases for CIA agents. Whoever they were, the two Americans are in stable condition, and they've already returned to the United States, and it's still not clear why the police would have ambushed them, whether it was a botched operation or whether it had to do with police corruption or some alliance with organized crime. Right now, 12 federal police are in custody, while the Mexican Attorney General's office investigates. The defense lawyers say the police were in the area on an undercover operation following the apparent kidnapping of an employee of Mexico's Anthropology Museum. It's not clear whether that kidnapping actually occurred. In a public event this week with the U.S. ambassador, President Felipe Calderón apologized, quote, profoundly. The whole episode has raised further questions about Mexico's federal police, which are supposed to be undergoing a thorough reform process. They're increasing their numbers rapidly. They're receiving lots of new training, much of it from the United States, which has trained several thousand federal police members. The federal police are the main security force that's ultimately going to have to take over if Mexico's army is ever to be pulled out of an internal security role. And this incident comes just shortly after another one in June, when two groups of federal police had a drug-related shootout right in the middle of Mexico City's international airport. These episodes are doing nothing to fix the federal police's already poor reputation for corruption and incompetence. And as the New York Times put it, quote, the notion that a squad of federal police officers would attack an embassy car could be another blow to the developing trust and cooperation between American counter-narcotics personnel and their Mexican partners. Finally, let's look at Guatemala, where a big deployment of U.S. Marines is carrying out operations to interdict drugs coming northward from the Andes. Somewhere between 170 and 200 Marines are in Guatemala right now. They brought with them four UH-1N Huey utility helicopters. They're armed, but only allowed to fire their weapons in self-defense. The Marines are supposed to be monitoring suspicious drug trafficking activity and then conveying that information to Guatemalan forces, who are then supposed to stop the traffickers and make the arrest. The operations are mainly taking place in western Pacific coastal Guatemala, but apparently will also cover the Caribbean. Quote, this is the first Marine deployment that directly supports countering transnational crime in this area, and certainly the largest footprint we have had in the area in quite some time, Marine Staff Sergeant Ernest Barnes told the Associated Press. The United States and Guatemala signed the agreement for this deployment on July 15th, and around August 12th, an Air Force cargo plane arrived in Guatemala with the Marines and their helicopters. According to AP, quote, after 2 weeks of setting up camp, establishing computer connections, and training at the Guatemalan air base at Retaluleu, the Marines ran through rehearsal exercises, Barnes said. Last week, their commander gave the thumbs up to begin active operations, end of quote. These operations are expected to last about 4 months, more or less, until the end of the year. Because it's focused on coasts and waterways, the Marines are working mostly with Guatemala's Navy. Not so much the police, even though the police should be playing a counter-narcotics role in the lead. They're staying at a base of Guatemala's Air Force and working with Air Force units, too. The Guatemalan Army, which is more controversial because of its very notorious human rights record, appears to have less heavy involvement, though some Army personnel are working with the U.S. Marines, among them members of the Northwest Task Force, based in San Marcos. The Marine deployment is part of Operation Martillo, or Hammer, which is SOUTHCOM's effort to increase anti-drug monitoring and interdiction near Central America's coasts. These coasts have seen a sharp increase in trafficking activity since about 2008, as traffickers began to send more planes and boats to Central America instead of longer trips through the Pacific and Caribbean. Operation Martillo started in January, and has also been very active in Honduras, where the Southern Command has helped build bases for drug interdiction on Honduran territory. There, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, has played a more active role than the U.S. military. DEA agents were involved in hostilities 3 times in Honduras in May and June of this year. In Guatemala, however, a DEA spokesman told the Associated Press that the agency's presence has not increased and they remain at their normal country presence level. There is no similar big Marine deployment in Honduras, meanwhile. And that's it for now. The U.S. Congress is still out, and we'll come back after Labor Day. The two political parties are holding their presidential nominating conventions for this fall's campaign. The Republican Party made public its platform this week, and it makes only a few references to Latin America. Most of the language is about Venezuela and Cuba, expressing outrage or concern about authoritarian behavior, Iranian influence, terrorism, and other threats. The document also calls for a bigger border fence with Mexico. In her blog, Latin Intelligence, Shannon O'Neill of the Council on Foreign Relations noted, quote, "On Latin America's two biggest economies, Brazil and Mexico, there's close to nothing in the platform." And overall, the Republican Party generally seems to see the region, when it considers it at all, as a threat rather than an opportunity. And that really is it for now. Thank you for listening to WOLA's Latin America Today and the Just the Facts podcast. Please keep listening. We're up on iTunes, where if you have a moment to write a review, we'd really appreciate the feedback, and it would help us a lot to reach new listeners. Please keep visiting WOLA's website, www.wola.org, and the Just the Facts website at www.justf.org. If you're finding these podcasts useful, please do consider making a donation to keep us going. You can also find both WOLA and Just the Facts on Facebook or on Twitter at WOLA_ORG and justf_ORG. Hasta pronto.